This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Claire Koss about the Broadway play she wrote, Emmett, Down in My Heart.
It's the 60th anniversary of the murder of the young man, Emmett Till, 14 years old, for flirting with a white woman in the Delta of Mississippi.
Professor Stephen Zunas joins us to talk about the complex issues in Yemen.
If you're wondering whether that war just dropped out of the sky, you'll hear the answer. And you'll also hear again how the United States has a deep role in that war.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Today, on April 22nd, the hosts of Law and Disorder are gathered to record our next show, and we're with Heidi Boghossian, Armenian, who just did an incredibly moving show for Law and Disorder that I again recommend everyone to listen to. It's online, and you should get it. What's it called, Heidi?
Speaking in Turkish, Armenian Genocide Denial.
And we're coming up to that day, the 24th, which is the 100th anniversary. But there's been some events even since you've produced that show. What are some of those?
Well, Michael, I think the main event, or lack thereof, is that Armenians in this country were hoping that President Obama would stay true to his campaign promise and actually use the word genocide in referring to the 1915 massacre of Armenians. And after much debate and allegedly opposition from some at the State Department and the Pentagon, the administration is not going to use the term when it mentions the events that happened 100 years ago. Now, this is in stark contrast to Obama's promise as a senator and presidential candidate, where he did use the word genocide. And in fact, Samantha Power recorded a nearly five-minute video at the time he was running for office imploring Armenian Americans to vote for Obama because he was going to keep his word on this issue. And there we have it. He has not done that.
And Samantha Power and President Obama, do they have an honest bone in their bodies? I don't think so. Let me ask you another question about this, because in 1987, the EU took action on this, the European Union. What did they do?
They acknowledged that it was a genocide, and I think that scholars, people who have studied this around the globe, acknowledge that the facts are not in dispute. And for political reasons, due to our ties with Turkey, we will not use that term. And in Turkey, genocide is not mentioned in any of the textbooks. The blame is shifted to the Armenians, saying that many Turks were killed during that same time. And I think there's a sense of national pride. And it's also a crime to mention the word genocide there. And people, when they do, suffer dire consequences, including physical violence. Some people have been killed for it. So it's a hot issue there.
Well, again, I want to recommend the program that Heidi did last week. It's incredibly moving. It's personal stories about people whose families were deeply separated, killed, murdered by this genocide.
Go to lawanddisorder.org.
Michael Ratner, Israel's Supreme Court just upheld key provisions of that country's so-called anti-boycott law. That makes it a civil offense for groups or people to advocate the boycotting of Israel or settlement products, institutions, individuals, and advocacy that might have a reasonable chance of succeeding. What do you make of this legislation?
You know, Israel has always looked at boycott, divestment, and sanction as probably their weakest, their most vulnerable point, because Israel is not going to change from the inside. So it's as countries around the world and students and young people and others begin to get involved in boycotting, forcing corporations and others, investment bankers, to divest and eventually sanctioning Israel for the occupied territories in particular, but for the internal situation as well in Israel. They react strongly. And this law that you just said, which was passed a couple of years ago, was challenged by a number of NGOs there who were involved in some way in boycotting or suggesting boycotting of products, particularly from the occupied territories. The hope was that the Israeli Supreme Court would uphold the law. Not they didn't hope it would, but they thought it might well uphold the law as far as Israel was concerned, but they would never allow the law to pass with regard to actions taken in the occupied territories. And the actions are of two sorts, I think. The first action is they can be given an injunction to be forced to stop it. Mm-hmm. And the second one is people who say they're affected by the boycott, they lose money, et cetera, they're allowed to sue the NGO. So it essentially squashes any kind of dissent in Israel in which you might advocate for boycott, divestment, and sanction.
And with those potential lawsuits, Michael, the persons involved might be subject to damages. So it has a real deterrent effect in terms of might hit the pocketbooks.
No, that's correct. The only thing they tossed was punitive damages, but good luck. It's still like it finishes up any kind of free speech. What's interesting about that Israeli action, of course, is there's action reflected similar to that in the United States. There's right now an anti-BDS legislation going through Congress right now. And Code Pink has just put out an alarm saying that Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat from Maryland, and as they describe him, an otherwise liberal Democrat, has been trying to shut down the BDS campaign, and now he's putting in legislation to do so. And the question is, in a Republican Congress, what will happen to that legislation in a Republican-dominated Congress, particularly when it's being pushed by the Democrats? So you're seeing that on the federal level, and I'm not sure what it will do here and what the sanctioning they can do for people on free speech who suggest these kind of boycotts. We'll see what happens with that. In addition to the federal government, states are doing it. Right now, the state of Illinois is in the process of passing legislation that would also prohibit engaging in boycott, divestment, and sanction. Again, what the consequences will be are not clear yet. But so this is sort of not just an Israeli thing. This is a U.S. issue as well.
Michael, elaborate on the point you made before with regard to the First Amendment and free speech. I mean, what if somebody says, don't buy X product from the West Bank of Israel because it helps the settlers oppress the Palestinians there? If you come out and say that, are you then liable to some kind of lawsuit?
Michael, your question is a good one, as whether people could be sued for engaging in BDS. Certainly, as I said, in Israel. Here, at least, the federal legislation is much more about discouraging, as it says in the federal legislation, politically motivated actions that limit commercial relations with Israel and Israeli businesses, including those operating illegally, and of course, doesn't say that, illegally in the Israeli colonies and the occupied territories. So it's basically trying to attack international opposition to Israel and support for BDS. And it's going to do that probably by eventually Congress doing something about countries that are engaged in the boycott, cutting off trade with them, putting on sanctions on them, or something like that.
You know, another irony is that here's an action taken by civil society, which is totally nonviolent. The governments of Israel and possibly the United States are going to try to cut that off.
No, but it's ongoing. You know, I think what we can see as we look at both the Israeli legislation, the federal, Illinois and other places, is it's happening, as we've said before on the show, and as Ali Abu Nima said when we interviewed him about his book, Battle for Palestine, that the BDS movement is growing substantially and significantly. It's getting deep grassroots support in the United States and across the world, and they're worried about it. So they're starting to come down very, very harshly. And there's a couple of other instances we can mention today in which there's been efforts to crack down, if not on the boycott directly, at least on Palestinian dissent. So, for example, not just in the U.S., here in the U.K., supposed bastion of our Magna Carta and free speech, we see this. In mid-April, there was a conference organized, International Law and State of Israel, Legitimacy, Responsibility, and Exceptionalism. It was supposed to take place April 17th to 19th in the University of Southampton in the U.K., The university blocked the conference, saying it couldn't do it because of reasons of health and safety. What does that mean? Well, what it did was it succumbed, as the article says, to pressure from Israeli lobby, including the Zionist Federation and the Board of Deputies of British Jews, who were backed by politicians. They then took it to the court. The supporters of the conference took it to the court. They went to the High Court, which is just below their Supreme Court, And in her judgment, Judge Alice Robinson upheld the university's position on a ridiculous basis, saying the organizers' academic freedom had not been impinged upon because the participants could express their positions at another conference, but not at this particular conference at this particular time. Well, that just makes a mockery of anything to do with free speech. As many of our listeners know, I'm affiliated with a group called Palestine Legal, or Palestine Legal Solidarity Support. And what it does is it monitors dissent on Palestine across the country and the suppression of that dissent. And it, you know, gets scores of complaints where they try and let students not speak, where they claim it's anti-Semitic, etc. And recently, last week, there was a headline in the New York Times with a large picture of a woman who alleged alleged anti-Semitism. And what happened is she was running for office at Stanford, and she went into the Students of Color Coalition to try and make her case that she should be endorsed. She alleged that they said, does your being Jewish affect your position on divestment, on BDS? Because the campus at university at Stanford has backed BDS quite heavily, and certainly the students of color had. So the New York Times has a headline which says, Student Coalition at Stanford confronts allegations of anti-Semitism. It's a half a page, big picture of Molly Horowitz, and the first five paragraphs are entirely her story. They ask this question, you're Jewish, does that affect how you feel about divestment, etc. Then the students from the coalition, nine
rebuttal.
Of them, do a rebuttal. Nine of them say this never happened. And they turn over their notes to the university. And, you know, it's certainly, I would say, you don't know from this distance whether this happened or not. But it's certainly questionable whether this incident happened. And you certainly think that the Times leading with this headline, this huge picture of the woman, and five paragraphs before you get to the denial is remarkable. And even after they give the denial by the student by the coalition of students of color, they go back again to the Anti-Defamation League, which says, "Well, this is serious, you know, as if this incident occurred, and it's a good teaching moment where about identity and being Jewish, etc." So the entire article is done to do one thing, which is to drive home that people who support BDS are anti-Semitic. And that's probably the main single way in which anti-BDS people try and beat back young students at campuses throughout this country. It's an outrage. Anti-Semitism has nothing to do with whether I'm against the practices of the Israeli state. And that's just crazy to me. It doesn't make any difference. It's about people. It's not about what a state does. I mean, it's nonsensical. But of course, that is, if you ask most people in this country, I think they would say, well, for Jews, it's very difficult on campus. There's a hostile atmosphere. There's all this anti-Semitism going on. But in fact, it's the exact opposite. The people whose language and speeches and talks don't get out are those who advocate for BDS and for basically against the war in Gaza or no occupied territories. Those are the people whose speech rights get suppressed. And that's why, both at this Palestine Legal Project and otherwise, we call what happens on American campuses and in this country the Palestine exception to the First Amendment. That's what we have.
The prize-winning play Emmett, Down in My Heart, is the true story of two female characters, Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, and a white teacher, Rowan Taylor, who frame the 1955 kidnap, torture, and murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till in the Mississippi Delta. Rowan is haunted by her silence and confronts her need to take responsibility and speak. Mamie Till Mobley, through outrage and grief, is transformed from a private citizen to a social justice activist. Many consider her insistence on an open casket to be the start of the modern civil rights movement. And 3 months later in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks said Emmett Till was the catalyst that motivated her when she refused to move to the back of the bus. Joining us to talk about Down in My Heart is Claire Koss, activist, writer, and psychotherapist. Her publications include Lillian D. Wald, Progressive Activist, which features the play and a selection of Wald's correspondence and speeches. For many years, Koss was the poetry editor for Ophelia, a journal of women and social work. She has taught at Hunter College, SUNY at Stony Brook, and is collaborating on her libretto, Emmett Till, the Opera, with composer Mary Watkins.
Claire Koss, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. So great to be here.
You were a young woman at the time of Emmett Till's murder. You're from the South, and you were going to school down there. Talk to us about what you first heard and what it was like.
Well, actually, I was my mother called me half Yankee and half rebel. I lived half in New Jersey and half in New Orleans, which is where she was from. I always thought rebel meant being a rebel, and in fourth grade history, I found out rebel meant the Confederacy, so that I stopped using that line very fast. My mother explained that the South never got over losing the Civil War and slavery, so the enslaved. But that I was a student at LSU in Baton Rouge in 1955 in the theater department. I had wanted to go to Newcomb, where she went, but she wouldn't let me out of the state because I had to live in a dormitory. I couldn't live at home. And at Newcomb, they said, no, your mother lives in New Orleans. You have to live at home. So that's what got me to this huge land-grant college in Baton Rouge. But in my junior year, Emmett Till was murdered just a few miles upriver in Mississippi. In the summer, when I came back to school in the fall, the trial was taking place. And that's when I first learned about it, because the news of his murder was kind of a buried story, small story in the Times-Picayune, where it was kind of, he was accused of being provocative. That was kind of the tone of the story, which I looked up many years later, because I had never seen it at the time. I had been to a Quaker boarding school in Locust Valley, Long Island, for my high school, and it just, the whole issue of Jim Crow was so disturbing to me when we would go down to visit my grandparents in the summer. I just couldn't stand the for colored only signs on the movie theaters. These hands, I wrote a poem, These Hands Touch Jim Crow, because I actually moved one of those lacquered for colored only signs back on the bus so I could get a seat by the window when I was about 7, and my mother explained, you see, those people have to stand because you moved that. I never touched it again. I never touched those little placards in all of the streetcars and buses again. It was upsetting to me. But when I was in seventh and eighth grade in Plainfield, New Jersey, the black grammar school burned down in Plainfield, and the kids were bused to different schools throughout the city. So we had about 20 black students bused to our school for 7th and 8th grade, and we got to be friends. And I think that was the first time I just realized that, you know, kids are kids. It doesn't matter what race you are. And ironically, in this play, Emmett Down in My Heart, because that story has lived down in my heart all these years.
1955, you're at the university.
Yes.
You hear about Emmett Till's murder. And tell us what happened. What were the facts, the basic facts in 1955 that came out?
In the summer of 1955, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old Chicago boy, begged his mother to go south with his Uncle Mose to visit his cousins in the Mississippi Delta. And she reluctantly allowed him to go. He was a very playful boy. He was a very innocent boy. And he had nice clothes. He had a leather wallet. He had money in his pocket. He had comic books he brought. And one of the kids was jealous of him, kind of provoked him to, let's say, dared him to flirt with a white woman in a grocery store. He took the dare, and he gave a very faint wolf whistle, and he said, "Bye, babe," when he left the store. And she ran out, the storekeeper went out and got her gun from her car, and then the kids all got back in their car and they raced back to church, which they had left. It was a Wednesday evening church service. He was visiting his Uncle Mose and Aunt Lizzie and his several cousins, their sons, who were sharecroppers. and the Mississippi Delta. It was a confluence of events because they thought since nothing had happened after 3 days, nothing would happen. But Roy Bryant, one of the killers, and Big Milam, the other killer, they were half brothers. They kidnapped him at midnight from Uncle Moe's and Aunt Lizzie's home. And they drove around all night looking for a steep cliff to drop him into the river. But they couldn't find it, so they took him to a small barn outside of Drew, Mississippi, tortured him for an hour, killed him, threw him in the Tallahatchie River with a 100-pound gin fan tied around his neck with barbed wire. He was caught in a drift, his body and his feet swung up, and a young boy fishing on the Pecan Point Bridge saw this, the feet, and that's how he was identified. He was pulled into shore. Uncle Mose came to identify him. He had worn his father's ring to Mississippi, and that was the one thing that he could definitely identify because his face and head had been destroyed by the murderers. It was one of the most horrific, horrific, gruesome, barbaric murders that is like an iconic moment in our nation's history. The only reason we know about it is because his mother, out of her grief and deep outrage and anger, insisted on an open casket, a glass-topped casket. Because
this was in Chicago, right?
When they went, yeah, the body got released because she knew somebody, a cousin in the Steelworkers Union in Chicago. He got to the mayor, Daley, who got to the governor of Illinois, who got to the governor of Mississippi, who then released the body back to Chicago. It was shown for viewing for 3 days. Thousands of people came by, and she said, "Let Mrs. Mamie Till said, let's tear the lids off of Mississippi. Let's show the world what a lynching looks like up close." And this changed our history.
Now, Claire, there was some subsequent events, and then I want to talk about the play you've written about it. There wasn't apparently a trial of the two people who murdered Emmett Till, is that right?
There was a trial. I think of it as a fake trial. There were five white lawyers from the town of Sumner. They collected money in glass jars in little stores all throughout the county and raised $10,000, which was significant in 1955. They were the town's best citizens, country club lawyers, country club members, and it was they joined together like a block to defend the murderers. They never once asked any questions of the murderers. They said they didn't want to know what they did. They did have an empathic prosecutor who did his best, but he had no resources. But the most amazing thing about the trial was Uncle Mose Wright, who was also a preacher, they called him Preacher, and Mamie Till Mobley both testified at the trial, as well as a sharecropping family who lived near the barn where he was tortured. And this was so amazingly daring, and it broke the Delta Code of, for the first time, a black man testified against a white man in the state of Mississippi. And there's a very famous picture of him standing up and pointing and saying, "There he is. There's the other one. There he is." And he stopped saying "sir" because everybody had to say "sir" down there. And Mose Wright stopped saying "sir." But in spite of the testimony where Mamie Till identified her son because she opened the casket herself, it was sealed, and they said she couldn't open it. She said, "Nobody told me. I didn't sign anything not to open it." So she did identify the body, and she said it was her son without a doubt. What they don't they don't listen to black testimony. It's true today, too. They listen to the authority of the white, whatever the white powers that be want. So they were found not guilty. The judge told them, sent in a round of Cokes to take, tell them to take a little longer so it would look good. And they came out, and they also said that they threw the case out, and essentially saying that murder is picked up in one county, can't be tried in another county, and the whole case was thrown out. They appealed to Eisenhower, never heard back from him, and his Justice Department never wanted to take it on.
Right, because they could have done a civil rights prosecution, but they never did.
Right.
And after that trial, the two murderers did admit in Life magazine, in Look magazine, that they had killed Emmett.
Yes. Huey, the journalist named Huey, he interviewed them. He paid them $4,000 to tell the true story. And they admitted that they murdered him, that he had pictures of three white girls in his wallet. And that's what this war is about down here. There was no point letting them get any bigger. But they left out the hour of torture. So they really lied in their portrayal of it. And it's really disturbing that people will read that Look magazine. There's two of them. There's a follow-up. And they think that this is the story, according to how they told, the murderers told it. But it isn't. If you really want to read the story, there's a wonderful memoir by Mamie Till Mobley called The Death of Innocence that she co-authored with a Chicago attorney. And there's a lot of articles and at the time in literature on this subject.
This horrific murder was really a launching point, wasn't it, for the civil rights movement that followed. Can you talk to us about that?
Actually, Jesse Jackson called the Emmett Till lynching, that he said it broke the emotional chains of Jim Crow. Rosa Parks said she was thinking about Emmett Till when she refused to remove on the bus. That was 3 months after his murder in December when she did that. So, the grocery store where he and Carolyn Bryant crossed paths is now considered ground zero of the civil rights movement.
We're talking to Claire Koss about her new play, not new play. Is it a new play? No, I saw a reading of this a long time ago, Claire.
Yes, it's been developing through readings.
Called Emmett, Down in My Heart, the true story of Emmett Till, but it also focuses on two women protagonists. Can you talk about that and how you decided to do this play and what your take on it is?
Well, as a white woman, I wasn't sure how I could write about this subject in a way that felt right. I invented the character of a teacher, a white teacher named Roanne Taylor, who had been the murderer's teacher, who was part of that Southern society. And it's the whole theme of, you know, caring and silence. People who care, but people who remain silent. The part of the impetus of this play for me is to show, you know, for Roanne Taylor, who was tortured because she heard his screams and didn't testify and didn't speak, as no white person did at the time, how does she get through that? And what is her journey? So she has to make some kind of step towards being responsible and breaking that white silence in order to be able to live with herself. And Mamie Till Mobley is the other great heroine. Not that Roanne is a heroine. She's a struggling person who has lost her moral compass. Mamie Till and Uncle Mose are heroes. They face death when they testify at the stand. And Mamie Till was, it just transformed her life from a privatized woman to a very big activist. She started out going on speaking engagements after the trial and sponsored first by the NAACP. And she was threatened with hate mail and death threats. And it was a totally nerve-wracking experience. They had to escape from Mississippi at night into driving into Tennessee. I mean, there was just treachery and danger, and she faced it all so courageously. And it just has made so much such a big difference, because everybody, when any one of these murders that seem to be happening so regularly at this moment in our current situation, Emmett Till's name is called out immediately. You know, another Emmett Till.
Or I would say Rachel Corrie and Rachel Corrie's parents coming forward reminded me of that. Well, let's talk about your play. It's at the Casillo Theater, which is on 42nd Street. If people will get a pencil, I'm going to give you the number to call.
It's called Castillo. Michael's.
Castillo.
212-941-5800. 212-941-5800. Tickets are not expensive, and the play will be on for another couple of weeks. And I encourage you to go, and I hope I see some of you people there. Anyway, let's talk some more about the play, Claire. Tell us what gave you the idea to do it, and how you've been working on it, and who you're working with.
Well, the play is being directed by Erica Gould, and we have a terrific ensemble cast of eight and a wonderful creative design team. It's opening Friday evening, April 17th. And I'm really, really delighted that it's opening. It's a community theater production at the Castillo, or Castillo. And I'm hoping that the direction of my heart will reach other people's hearts. As one of the Mississippi state senators said, and now there are more black representatives from Mississippi than any other state, he said, you know, we've changed the laws, now we have to change the hearts. And it's my hope that this will be one of the works of art, of many works of art on Emmett Till, that will help to change the hearts and for people to have a kind of consciousness about the necessity that if you are a caring person, you have to do something. You can't just be caring, because that does nothing.
I think that's crucial. I'm interested in how Mississippi has reacted. You mentioned that the grocery store was sort of iconic, but officially, have they done anything about it? How's his case looked at in Mississippi?
It's so interesting. Now that there are many black office holders, like mayors and town supervisors, representatives, things have changed. There is now an Emmett Till trail, a civil rights trail. There's a museum, an Emmett Till museum. There's a curriculum in the state from the lowest K grade through high school that must include the history of civil rights in Mississippi. So there are definite changes. And because there's now black office holders, they are now acknowledging, you know, what happened in Mississippi. As long as the white office holders were in power, you couldn't mention Emmett Till. But that has now transformed.
And we should note that in 2004, the United States Department of Justice officially reopened Emmett Till's case. Right.
Yes, but they had a grand jury that said it was just there wasn't enough evidence to do anything.
Yeah, a confession doesn't count as evidence, evidently. Claire, do you have any final thoughts you want to share with us?
Well, you know, I was working on writing an article or a preface for the play. And I came across the fact that George Washington has 123 enslaved people in his ownership, men, women, and children. And he was very troubled by it. But he decided, and he got a gift of 15 slaves when he was 11 years old. And he was very troubled by it. And he thought, you know, I really want to free these people. And he just thought, I can't do it. It will just disturb the nation too much. I can't do it. I'll put it in my will. When Martha and I are dead, then they can be freed. And I just had this terrible feeling, like people who care and who can't act, starting with our first president.
I think that's an important point. I remember the story about George Washington. What I'm trying to recall is whether they were really freed or that a nephew took over the estate, as I recall, and a lot of them did not get freed.
That's right. But his intention was.
Right, his intention after he was dead and no longer needed them. You gave an answer that said it would hurt the nation, and how could he do that? But in fact, of course, it would have destroyed him, in his view, economically, I think, also.
Right, yes. And I try to get this in my play, the social strata of, you know, the country club lawyers who defended the murderers, and then the murderer, Roy Bryant, who says, you know, we do the dirty work. We have to keep everything all cleaned up so everything stays in order. I mean, it's like, and then the economic situation of the poverty and how the whole society just needs to be restructured economically in order for us to have justice and dignity in this country. And that is part of a theme in the play.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the fact that the state of Indiana, for example, you don't think of it as a Ku Klux Klan state, but there were a great number of Ku Klux Klan members in the state of Indiana. And the way the system works, it divides the blacks from the whites, and it keeps the whites on top of the blacks. And instead of taking a look at the whole picture of what's wrong with it, it perpetuates that way. And, of course, the people on the top allow that to happen.
Well, I want to just say a word for the cast. They're just amazing. We have a very talented cast. The set is like a very imaginative set, and the staging is immersive staging. I'm so pleased with how the show is coming alive in this production.
Yeah, I'm really, despite the nature of the subject, I'm really excited to see it. I saw it in reading here, I think, in the Village. And now I'm really glad you put it together as the play, and it's going to play for a month. So Claire, it's the 60th anniversary this year of Emmett
That's
Till's
right.
death.
That's right, 60
so,
years.
So important for people to see, and important for people to see the links with what was then, and of course what is today. So thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today, we're going to try and untangle the war in Yemen. You read a lot about it. Is Iran helping the Houthis? Why is Saudi Arabia stopping the bombing? What's the role of the United States? How did this war come about? What happened to civil society? Well, these are not easy answers, at least if you read the American newspapers. But they're actually our answers. And today, we're going to be interviewing Professor Stephen Zunis on these issues, Yemen, civil society, and the wider Middle East. Professor Zunis is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. He serves as a senior analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies. Professor Zunis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Stephen, today we want to talk to you about particularly Yemen and then go a little broader. But there's something in the paper every day about Yemen. Today, as we're recording this, which is on the 22nd, we read that Saudi Arabia is going to stop bombing Yemen. So can you just have our listeners, who you have to assume need a sort of basic understanding of what's going on, what's happening in Yemen, and what does the Saudi announcement mean?
Oh, what's been happening in recent months is that the Houthi militia, which is based in the Zaidi minority in the north, the Zaidis practice a form of Islam that's something of an offshoot of the Shia tradition. It's been around for many, many centuries. They've traditionally been marginalized and oppressed by the central Yemeni government. They've had a series of rebellions over the past decade or so, defending what they saw as encroachment on of their rights. But in starting last year, they went well beyond the their regional area and moved south, took over the capital of Sana'a, and they continue to move south and have been battling for control of the important port of Aden. Apparently being backed by militia loyal to the former dictator and their former rival, Ali Salah. Most Yemenis very much opposed this offensive and have resisted both violently and nonviolently. Indeed, the Houthis were unable to seize Taiz, the third largest city, due to hundreds of thousands of people going out to the streets without guns saying, no, we're not going to let you take our city. But more problematic, instead of leaving the Yemenis to sort it out, Saudi Arabia, with U.S. support, has for the past month engaged in heavy bombing raids, which have done very little to halt the Houthi advance. Indeed, in fact, they've actually expanded the territory they have controlled during this period, but has done a lot of damage to civilian infrastructure and killed a lot of people. And even among the Yemenis who oppose the Houthis, they are very much concerned about the Saudi role, given Saudi history of intervening in Yemeni affairs, their rather reactionary interpretation of Islam, authoritarian orientation, and their support for hardline Salafi Sunni groups, which are in themselves problematic.
Can you give us a little background here? What all of a sudden got the Houthis to start moving into a war? There's allegations that Iran is somehow helping the Houthis, which may be why Saudi Arabia is concerned. Why is Saudi Arabia concerned?
Well, one certainly can't rule out Iranian support for the Houthis. I have not seen any clear evidence that they have. It's a long-standing habit of the Saudis and of Washington, for that matter, to blame the Iranians for any challenge to the status quo in that area. Indeed, the Obama administration has admitted that they have evidence that the Iranians actually tried to talk the Houthis out of seizing Sana'a back in January. But clearly the Houthis have their own agenda. Furthermore, Yemen is awash with arms after many decades of tribal and factional warfare. There are more guns per capita in Yemen than any country in the world, unless you count the United States. And so clearly they can get a hold of weapons, including vast stores of ammunition they have captured during their offensive. So this assumption that their military advance is possible only because of Iranian assistance or alleged Iranian assistance seems pretty far off. The reason the Houthis, despite representing only a minority of Yemenis, have been able to advance so much is that the rest of Yemeni society has been pretty divided, at least among the armed groups. But you have to go back further to 2011, when millions of Yemenis from across the spectrum in terms of tribal affiliation, religious orientation, and region took to the streets against the U.S.-backed dictatorship, Ali Saleh. A broad coalition of oppositionists put together a 143-member national council, which they proposed would be the interim government until there could be free multi-party elections. And this national council ranged from leftist to traditional tribal leaders to members of the ruling party who had defected to civil society leaders, protest leaders, included the Houthis. It included South Yemeni separatists. It was a broad coalition. But the Saudis, with U.S. support, rejected this and instead engineered a transfer of power to Saleh's vice president, Major General Hadi, and basically marginalizing the very impressive nonviolent pro-democracy civil society movement that had hoped to transform Yemen into a more pluralistic and democratic and representative system. And what happens is when you marginalize civil society, you create a power vacuum where the men with guns end up filling that space. And this is exactly what happened. So I think it would not be unfair to argue that it was the Saudis and Washington, in fact, that helped create the conditions that have led to the Houthi advance and the destruction that has followed.
Stephen, I saw in the paper it was reported that the Saudis have enforced an embargo that's not allowed the Yemenis to get food or water or fuel or medicine. And then I saw that an American official was interviewed, and they asked him, why did the Saudis stop the bombing? And he said, too much collateral damage. So my question to you is, assuming that the bombing is not going to resume, what do you think the Saudis are going to do next?
Certainly they're going to want to play a major role in whatever negotiations or whatever political process may come forward. But as long as civil society is ignored and is marginalized, as long as they try to impose a solution based on various competing elites and warlords and other factions that are not representative of the Yemeni people, it's not going to work. Well, what's really been frustrating about this whole thing is that, you know, despite the pro-democracy rhetoric that you constantly hear coming out of Washington, you know, the Obama administration not only betrayed the pro-democracy aspirations of the Yemeni Arab Spring Revolution, but they have sided and worked with and backed the efforts of Saudi Arabia, one of the most brutal authoritarian regimes in the world, in imposing their preferred political solution on this very complex society.
Steve, another question on Yemen, and I don't want to talk about civil society in general, but this question has to do with, I guess, 2011 is Arab Spring. The U.S. has been, during that period, you know, dropping drones all over Yemen, or at least in some parts of Yemen. How did that drone war by the U.S. affect the events we're seeing today, if at all?
Well, one of the reasons the U.S. has been so eager to support Hadi and before that Saleh and, you know, various strongmen is that we felt we needed strong leadership to fight the threat from Al-Qaeda, which is very active in rural areas of Yemen. They are seen to be the most dangerous Al-Qaeda group in terms of their ability to go beyond their borders. Some of the more famous, infamous attempted terrorist attacks from the bringing explosives on air cargo to the underwear bomber to the shoe bomber apparently originated in from the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based in Yemen. But the irony is that the U.S. drone strikes have made things far worse. The collateral damage from those have turned a lot of the rural population, especially in certain tribal groups that had initially opposed Al-Qaeda, to ally with them. Indeed, in one of the most horrific incidents, a group of highly respected tribal leaders who were very tired of Al-Qaeda operatives and militia coming through their area, throwing their weight around, trying to impose, you know, their brutal authoritarian version of Islam on the population, basically called them on the carpet and said, okay, folks, we've got to talk about this. And they arranged a big meeting, the Al-Qaeda leaders and these various tribal leaders, to try to work something out. Well, the U.S. saw these Al-Qaeda leaders and others coming to for this big meeting somewhere and ended up attacking them with drones, killing not only some of the Al-Qaeda leaders, but some of the most respected sheikhs and other notables in Yemen. And this turned those entire tribes over to ally with Al-Qaeda, greatly expanding their power and influence in the rural areas. And just yet another example of when the United States tries to impose military solutions in these societies we know very little about, even putting aside the moral and legal questions, ends up being a disaster in terms of America's strategic interests.
Stephen, I can't say that this was an uplifting report, particularly around the role of the United States again. But going forward, you'd mentioned something about working with the groups, you know, the grassroots or civil society groups. Can you articulate that a little bit more? And where's a way out of this?
Yeah, despite the country's poverty and fascist history, there is a very lively civil society movement, not just in what we saw back in 2011 with that very impressive, massive, nonviolent movement, the months of a peaceful encampment in Sana'a, despite snipers and other government forces killing hundreds of unarmed people. But in terms of grassroots initiatives for development, organization, we resisting the Houthi advance. I mentioned how in Taiz, the third largest city, hundreds of thousands of nonviolent, unarmed Yemenis were able to resist the planned Houthi takeover at Sana'a University, the country's leading institution of higher learning. Houthi forces occupied that last fall, and the students engaged in weeks of strikes and protest, forcing the Houthis to withdraw, and they were able to reclaim their campus. We've seen a whole series of strikes in various sectors of industry. We have seen government officials resign en masse. We have seen women's groups and trade unionists and academics and lawyers and others out on the streets. Even despite all the crazy civil war going on, there has been a remarkable resistance by ordinary Yemenis using classic techniques of strategic nonviolent action, saying, let's no more guns, no more militia, no more foreign military intervention. Let's settle this ourselves nonviolently. And so, again, this, to emphasize that the Houthis, people are very upset at the Houthis and what they've done, but they do not want to see foreign military intervention, especially by countries which have proven that they have no respect for the Yemenis' right to determine their own future.
Yemen isn't sort of unique, I think, in terms of what's going on in the Middle East right now. And you talked about the role of civil society, particularly after the Arab Spring. Can you have some sense, give us, our listeners, an overview sort of what happened to the civil society movement? We had Tunisia, we had Egypt, other places. And did the U.S. play an analogous role to what they've played in Yemen? What sort of happened to Arab Spring is really the question, but is Yemen emblematic of that?
In many ways, it is. The Obama administration, like administrations before it, both the Republican and Democratic, have tended to support authoritarian allies. Even the Bush administration, despite its pro-democracy rhetoric, they talked about spreading democracy from Damascus to Tehran, though they didn't talk about, and though I think we could all agree that Syria and Iran could use more democracy, they weren't talking about spreading democracy, from Cairo to Rabat to Riyadh, capitals of various U.S. Allies. And the Obama administration, to its credit, recognizing the dangerous implications of the neoconservative pro-democracy rhetoric, toned down this idea of regime change and U.S. intervention in the cause of democracy. But unfortunately, they went back kind of to the status quo ante of the realpolitik of supporting friendly autocrats. And though they did do, again, to their credit, some quite behind-the-scenes work in terms of supporting various political prisoners and trying to encourage a little more openness, to encourage agency by the people in these countries themselves, and not pretend the U.S. can go and try to impose democracy as if that was our goal in the first place. But when it came to the Arab Spring, there is some divisions. President Obama and a number of people within the National Security Council, you know, like Michael McFaul, Samantha Power, others, seem to be fairly sympathetic initially. And the president tended to side with that tendency. But you had a lot of pushback from Secretary of Defense Gates, Secretary of State Clinton, who believe the United States should support our allied autocrats and were afraid the civil society movements could destabilize things against U.S. interest. In certain cases, like Tunisia and Egypt, President Obama belatedly went on came to the side of the pro-democracy forces. In the case of Bahrain, we ended up backing the monarchy and the Saudi invasion to crush that pro-democracy struggle. And in Yemen, we played a mixed role, helping to ease out Saleh, but again, transferring power to his vice president instead of allowing the pro-democracy struggle to take its course. It's been definitely a mixed bag. I'm really sad to see the reverses in Egypt. The United States has done very little to discourage it. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, President Obama ended up ending what remaining restrictions there were on exports of armaments to the military-dominated government there, despite human rights abuses going on now that rival those of the Mubarak regime. But overall, the current situation is pretty depressing outside of Tunisia, where they have indeed made some very impressive gains for democracy and social justice. Outside of Tunisia, things don't look very good right now. But in the long term, I'm actually hopeful, because we have a new generation of Arabs, the 18 to 35-year-olds, who are a huge proportion of the population, who do not like the old autocrats, whether they're the ones that are cozy with Western interests, or those who use these pseudo-socialist nationalist slogans to justify their rule. But they're also dubious of the Islamist, especially the more extremist variety. This generation is secular in outlook. And by secular, I don't mean not religious, and most of them are observant Muslims, but they don't believe that the state should enforce a particular interpretation of Islam. They are tend to be left-leaning. They want more social justice, more economic equality. They are nationalistic. They don't want to be dominated by outside powers. This is the future of the Arab world. They're more educated. They're more connected to the internet and to the outside world. And they know that despite the setbacks, they do have the power of bringing down, or at least threatening to bring down, well-entrenched governments, not through force of arms, but by massive non-cooperation, contestation of public space, alternative institutions, and nonviolent direct action. So again, things are pretty depressing right now, but I actually think we will see a major shift in a positive direction over the next few decades.
Well, that's actually very encouraging to hear from you. We've been speaking with Professor Stephen Zunis. And Stephen, I know you've written a tremendous amount on all these issues. You have a website that people can go for a lot of these articles?
Sure. It's just my name. It's www.stephenzunis.org. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N-Z-U-N-E-S, one word.
Well, thank you for being with us, and I'm sure we're going to have you on again. A lot we didn't ask, one about Palestine and Israel and the effect of all this on that. And secondly, as you know, I'm going off to Western Sahara, and I want to be able to talk to you about that on the show as well.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Sure thing.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.